Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, producer Jonah Primo here, and welcome to Principle of Charity, where we inject curiosity and generosity back into our conversations on big social issues. So just a quick update for everyone. This is the end of season 4, and we'll be taking a few weeks off releases. But we have some exciting announcements and big things in store for season 5, so we'll talk more to that in the next show after the season break. This is part 2 of our conversation on whether or not AI can create art. Part 1, where Emil really teases out the topic, was released last week, so that'll provide the context for today's recording, which is on the couch with Lloyd, and he's going to throw the guests curveballs and unfiltered questions. As always, if you enjoy the show, please leave a review. Here is On the Couch.
Thank you, Ahmed and Michael. That was a phenomenal conversation with Emil. I want to go to the principle of charity now and focus on that and start really, as we often do in this segment, with the alternative view and trying to get you to articulate the alternative view and the strongest part of it. And so, Michael, I'll start with you, maybe highlight the top 2 or 3 arguments in favor of the idea that an AI system can create great artwork.
I think the first point that would come to mind is the idea of technical proficiency. So I wonder if it's helpful to think in terms of the forger, right? The forger who is able to copy the great artist to such a degree that the human, the ordinary human, and maybe even many experts cannot quite distinguish the two pieces, right? So can AI generate an image that would be almost impossible to distinguish from something that was created by someone we deem as a great artist, right, of history past? I'm hard-pressed to say that it would be impossible for AI to achieve that level of technical proficiency. And so if that is the measure by which we think of great art, then I think there's a sense in which perhaps then we might say, yes, it achieves that. It is possible for it to achieve that level of technical proficiency if it figures out hands, for example, or whatever. And I am taken by the notion of AI as a tool, right? That it can become a genuine partner in the work of human creativity. I'm absolutely open to the possibility that it could serve that role. I don't think of myself as an artist, right? So I would want to be open to the subjective experience of artists who genuinely feel that the AI has become not a substitute for their creative work, and not someone who merely sort of goad into generating something that we might call an image or art, but that actually becomes part of the artist's subjective experience. It works alongside the artist, with the artist, in subjection to the artist's intention and will, or maybe elicits elements that were latent in the artist they seek to generate some new work of art. So I think in those two ways, I'd certainly be open to the possibilities.
Wonderful. Thank you, Michael. Ahmed, let's go to you. What are the 2 or 3 best arguments to support the view that no AI system could ever create a true piece of art?
My argument is that art is created by human for humans, and AI will always be a tool in the process, no matter how you use it. There's always going to be a human behind the loop, behind the scene. Whoever programmed it, whoever fed the data, whoever put the prompt, whoever trained it, it is always a human who framed the question. And AI is just a creative tool. It's a newer kind of tool that is creative, but it's working for the artist to create art. Art is only created by human because there is a human who decide what to say, what to do.
Mm-hmm. Michael, I'm going to stay still with the alternative view. In your conversation with Emil, a lot of your work is about connection. What would be the two or three strongest arguments that AI is enabling human connection?
The way I tend to think about some of these issues, and not just raised by AI, but by other tools that mediate human relationships, right? There's always this question of the degree to which the tool has a bent. It has a tendency, right? It inclines us in certain ways. It readily opens certain doors and not others. And so that if we go with the grain of the affordances of the tool, we will tend in a certain direction. That's one mm-hmm. side of it. The other side of it is the degree to which the creative individual can use a tool against its grain and elicit from it maybe possibilities that were not what we might think of as its default settings, right? Mm. That when tools come sort of preloaded with certain affordances or certain literal default settings in terms of, you know, software, digital tools, there are ethical implications involved, right? In the way that it will incline the user who may be less interested in trying to achieve some measure of independence from those settings. And
right. How does AI enable human connection, I suppose, is right. the alternative view to you?
In various fields, in various cases, there's that tension where it is possible that a tool can foster a kind of human connection. And maybe that requires a willingness to explore how we might use it against the grain, against yeah. its grain, you know. So I think what I don't want to eliminate is simply the possibility that humans will connect with one another under all sorts of circumstances. And it's, you know, often in circumstances where the deck is stacked against the possibility of human connection, and nonetheless, yeah. People will find each other, right?
Okay.
Now, if you're asking me, are there tools that are explicitly designed for that in ways that, you know, I think are wholly benign, I'm not entirely sure. I think I would want to think about that, yeah.
Thank you. I mean, let me throw the alternative to you, meaning what would be the one or two strong arguments that you could posit that AI is destroying human connection?
Yeah, I'll give you argument both for destroying and enhancing human connection. Let's start by enhancing human connection first. AI make it possible for any person to generate an image by writing a simple prompt now. And I see it as a way to make human express their creativity in an easy way. You don't have to be talented in drawing or painting to make an image like that. And then you post this image to, for example, Instagram, and some people like it. And you're making connection here. You are really connecting to other through creation of images that are made by AI, and you are involved in the process. So that definitely enhance human connections because it's allowing me to express my creative intentions in new ways without having to be talented in art. On the other hand, with all the issues now of copyright and these systems being trained on images of artists without their consent, artists will be very, very reluctant to put their images online as before. I see this as something that will destroy human connections. Artists will keep things behind closed door now more, that's definitely affects the human experience of human creativity, because now I'll be confronted every day with AI generated images, which will soon become stagnant and not really that interesting, and I'm looking for something new, and that new things that I used to find out on art websites where that artists post their web images into will become totally deserted and become full of AI-generated images, and I will not find the human creativity anymore that excites me every day. So that definitely destroyed the human connection.
You've created and have founded AI centers. You're doing really novel research around AI. You've, you know, working on Beethoven's 10th Symphony. What are the chances, bearing in mind Immanuel Kant's definition of genius, meaning novel and influential? What do you think in 50, 80 years' time we're going to think of you as an artistic genius based on that matrix? What do you think the potential is?
I think it might be all forgotten because it's very hard to write history these days with the internet even being rewritten with AI itself. Mm. So you never know who will, what will the internet will say 10 years from now about what we are discussing now. So it's very unpredictable.
You know, that definition worries me a little, I have to say, because I understand the dimension of, you know, novel and how that there's a lot of agency in that. But to also articulate artistic genius as having to have influence seems to me that there's sometimes a lot less agency in influence. A lot of it is luck. I'm assuming that some people can be way too innovative, and as a result, because they're way too innovative, they miss the influential boat by a series of circumstance, or they're too far ahead of the game. What's your view on that? Is that influence is largely somewhat luck, and sometimes that people who are too innovative, you know, don't get classified as artistic genius?
Totally. I think you are right. I mean, there is actually a theory in psychology related to that by Professor Martin Dale, who was at University of Maine. And his theory is really say that artists all the time try to push against habituation. You look at the same artwork again and again, you got bored of it. You don't even notice it anymore if it's in your wall. And artists really have to push to create something novel, to excite the viewer. However, if they generate something too novel, people will not like it because it will be negatively received. And that's exactly the example of Picasso, Les Avignon, when everybody hated that artwork. It's really too novel, too shocking. And shocking art in general is in that part where it's really too shocking, too innovative, and most audience doesn't like it. Mm. So basically, artists have to push against habituation, but in what's called least effort, how to find a sweet spot between innovation but not too much innovation. And influence is really a big question. What is influential? Because that's really a question of the viewer. Is that art that I'm looking at influence me and inspire me and make me want to copy it? Do you see it when you see some striking new style in art and everybody start to copy it? And that's exactly what makes a great art. What makes that a big part of it is a social context. What's happening in society is that art is telling me something that excites me and inspire me that I want to copy it. Is it something totally novel that click with me? It's very hard to define this aspect, what is influential and what's not influential. Because creative artists all the time create novel things in all directions. But what clicks with the society as well, clicks with other artists is really depending on the context. And what clicks in Australia, for example, will be different from what clicks in London or in Africa. Right. Again, all that depends on many, many aspects. So the influence is really something that relates to the context and the social elements.
And has some randomness to it.
Totally.
I'm gonna stay with you, Ahmed, for a moment. Let's call that I've got a 1-800 Ahmed line, right, for personal counseling. I'm at a dinner party, or I'm in conversation, I'm having a beautiful brunch, and I do hang out with a lot of artists, whether they are actors, musicians, jugglers. I do hang out with them, and I find that they use the word creative. I'm a creative, they will say. We are creatives. In fact, I think the Australian, one of the state governments has just set up a fund for the creative industry. And I find this word very problematic, based in part on your definition. So let's assume I hear that word. And I phone Ahmed and I say, Ahmed, listen, I'm very upset about these people. They seem to have colonized the word creative. There are lots of people who are creative in technology, in business, in science. What's going on here? Why do you think the autistic community has colonized this word?
That's a very interesting point. I think the word creative is used for different meanings by different people. And nowadays, people use it in general to creating, if you are creating anything in terms of content, or in terms of videos, music, visual art, designs, marketing material, illustration, under all that, you call that creative, a creative domain. It doesn't necessarily mean that what you're creating is really actually creative by definition of novelty, and because it can create something that's for consumption, basically, everyday consumption. You still are because it's considered a creative person, but according to that definition, but this is not the creativity you're discussing, which is really creating something novel.
Okay, I'm going to use that when I speak to my creative friends, and so I don't alienate them, I'm just going to alienate you if you don't mind.
Okay.
From them, you know, it's a transaction. You don't know them, so I'm going to get free price here. Michael, I want to come to you. You've written so much about culture. We've spoken on this podcast about tight cultures, loose cultures. Tight cultures tend to be quite conformist, quite emphasize homogeneity. The rules are clear. You know how to behave. Loose cultures tend to give the individual a lot more opportunity to express themselves, allow them to innovate, tend to be a little bit more conflictual. If I was thinking about art and I was putting this into a model, would it be that and let's just take country cultures for the moment, would it be that America, which tends to be a looser culture than, say, Japan, which is a tighter culture, am I likely to get more artistic talent in America rather than Japan purely based on the fact that America is a looser culture and therefore emphasizes individual difference more?
My gut reaction is no, right? Because it would somehow invalidate great traditions of Japanese art. Right? I think you get more novelty, perhaps, right? And I, you know, it's novelty is one of the key words throughout our conversation tonight. And what is the relationship? For Kant, there's the novel and the exemplary, right? You know, Kant reflects a very specific moment in human history, right? Where you do have a rise in the value of autonomy, right? That is obviously very central to Kant's project, and to self-determination. We pass through, you know, the Romantic Age just shortly thereafter, where newness and novelty come to define, to some degree, what it means to be artistic. But those same values would certainly not have defined what is of artistic merit in the medieval age, say, right? And so I don't know whether then I want to say that because, for example, America may be a little looser and a little more dynamic is a word sometimes that is used, I think, in this context, right? That it necessarily generates more art. It may generate more novelty. And by the same token, if we, you know, I am taken presently, you know, by the degree to which art is mimesis, right? Art is an attempt to faithfully capture some truth about the world, the degree to which you work within a tradition over a long period of time, a cultural tradition, and that what is being generated is art, and because it lacks a high degree of novelty, it does not strike the members of that culture as somehow being less than artistic.
Right.
There's an observation, I think it was by Ross Anderson, at some point where he noted how when we look at certain examples of art that we find in cave dwellings from prehistoric times, and how the renderings have a striking uniformity over a strikingly long period of time, right? So say 15,000 years. And I think to modern ears, one might say, well, that was a striking lack of creativity, right? Because there was no novelty. And I would want to question that, right? I would want to question the degree to which the novelty must define the creative impulse, the artistic impulse, and whether or not we might not read that, as I think Anderson does in this observation, as being a culture that is, to some degree, rather pleased, right? Takes pleasure, satisfaction in what it is generating, so that we do not see it as a lack, but as a kind of virtue within the context of the values of that particular right. culture, right?
Key theme in our podcast, The Principle of Charity, is decency, understanding the other, tolerating the alternative view. I want to move to the subject of separating the art from the artist. I mean, there's this sort of ever-going debate of whether we should separate the art from the artist. And some works of art, genius works of art, have been created by potentially some very ugly people. You know, there are great debates about whether we should consume the work of Picasso or Miles Davis based on some of their history. Should we consume work from people who have been somewhat extremely hateful or sided with fascists or sided who anti-Semites or sided with Hitler or whatever? Should we consume their work?
I have no problem with that. I think they are who they are. We can study their biography, their history. We can have our opinion about them, which obviously change over time depending on the cultural and historical moment. But when it comes to their art, it has to be taken into the context of when it was created and what was the norms at the time and what is acceptable and what's not. And at the end, art, a big part of it is the viewer experience. I experience the art in a museum or a wall, even without knowing who is the artist. I can still experience it and can still enjoy it or not. Knowing who is the artist add to that, knowing what the artist want to say and what's the artist's history and what's background and personality add to that or take away from that, but it doesn't affect my experience of the art itself. So I think it's very critical issue, very hard to decide on, but my viewpoint is that we should look at the art independent of the people.
Michael, how about you?
Yeah, I would say it's certainly a vexed question. I do not think the answer is simply no, or that you know, such art should be preemptively stricken from our experience. There's always a question of who's doing that. I'll build on just Ahmed, your closing comments, right? That there is a relationship we establish with a work of art if we're willing to attend to it long enough, right? So I may encounter a painting knowing nothing of its provenance, knowing nothing of its of the artist who created it or their biography. And I think for one thing, I think artists themselves have conflicting views on this. You know, some saying that there ought to be no connection between the art and the and the biography and the work of art. Ultimately, I think I find that less convincing. I think that the two are inextricably linked. And part of my argument with which we opened, you know, about art mediating two human beings, you know, connecting people, I think would predispose me to say it matters something what the biography of that person may be, right? Mm-hmm. So I would say it complicates my relationship,
okay,
right? So as I learn about whether it's the deeds or the philosophy or the ideology, it may begin to complicate my relationship to that work of art. And it may be that one individual, under the weight of their own moral conscience, may decide that the work of art is something they want to move on from, whatever initial relationship they had. And I think, you know, the individual has a liberty of conscience to make that decision without necessarily prescribing it for everyone else. But I think it would be, as I do learn, as I seek to, you know, deepen my understanding of work art that compels me to do that, it would be inevitable that I might encounter, you know, elements of the biography that, again, just simply complicate my relationship. And I do wonder whether there are various ways in which we can talk about somebody's biography. You know, certain deeds done in their youth, which are a result of their, you know, exuberance or lack of wisdom, or whether it's some deep-seated ideology, right?
Yeah.
A kind of fascist ideology that then inevitably must permeate the work, right? And must then become a point of
which I was thinking much more around the extreme rather than, you know, the imperfections of an individual. Let me stay with the theme of the issue of humanity, humanitarianism. Recently, Amnesty International were called out for using AI images in a report to depict protesters in Colombia. And critics sort of indicated that Amnesty's credibility was undermined as a news source because they had just created these images. And their argument would be, well, you know, in potentially is there was no real alternative. We couldn't get these images out, potentially images of refugees. What's your view? Should human rights organizations, should they be allowed to create images, AI images, even if they're not real, in order to get their message across?
I think maybe even the prior question is the, again, on a sort of spectrum, whether the, rhetorically speaking, right, whether the images slide towards manipulativeness, right, or whether they honor the dignity of the subject.
Well, let's assume they do. Let's assume for in this case that they do.
Yeah. So if I'm counseling one of these agencies, I think my counsel would be to avoid the practice. You know, for one example, I can imagine some portion of the target audience discovering that the images are in fact AI generated or that they're not representing some truth. I think you run the risk then of damaging your credibility with some segment of the audience, right? That you are then seen to be misrepresenting the situation in ways that they then lack the capacity to trust you. And I think so much of you know, current information ecosystem, the critical question is the establishment and sustenance of trust. And so I do wonder if that would not be in that way counterproductive. And then there's a question again of the data upon which these images are trained. And I think there's something to be said for, you know, honoring the human subjects of the images upon which these new images are trained. And to me, I haven't thought very deeply about this, but it seems like that raises a strong hesitation on my part about the use of such images.
Amit, I want to go to you. In one of your TED Talks, you described yourself, did you describe yourself as a geek or a nerd?
It was a geek, Lloyd. It was a geek.
It was a geek. I have to know, what's great about being a geek?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I find myself enjoy coding, like the best thing I can do, spend my day on is just coding, talking to machines, basically. I connect with early days of programming where people were talking about programming as an art. Like Donald Knuth had this big book about art of programming called Art of Programming. So there is something artistic about coding that I myself enjoy interacting with machines through coding and writing code and spending lots of time doing that and finding ways to create art using coding myself, which is really I finding very interesting and very amazing that I write code that can generate art that surprises me as a human. So yes, I definitely call myself a geek.
You love the logical and the analytical.
Totally.
We often play a game called net positive, net negative. I'll give you a statement if you're up for it, and all you need to say is net positive or net negative, and with one sentence about why. Michael, I'm going to start with you, Madame Tussaud.
Is there an option for no opinion?
No.
No.
We love points of view.
Right. I'll go with net positive. Why not? I think there's an established sort of tradition of experiencing such displays that maybe generate a certain playfulness or a certain relationship to the past that might be net positive.
Okay. Amit, extroverts.
Net negative.
Why?
I'm an introvert myself, and I feel that the world we're living in now are dominated by extroverts because of social media and influencers and things like that. And that hurts introvert people who really have less chances to express themselves and be heard in this today's world.
There really is a little bit of a war between the extroverts and the introverts, isn't there? We just don't call it out. Michael, GPS.
So just to be provocative, I'll say net negative. I think it's altered our relationship to place in ways that have alienated us from place, from geography, from the details and history of the world around us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Ahmed, Los Angeles.
Made positive. I like it. I enjoy
you do?
Visited. Okay. Yeah, it's a cultural place, Hollywood, and definitely affect our life. We might like it or not, but I would say made positive.
Michael, Spotify.
Net negative on the principle that, I say this as somebody who uses Spotify to some degree, net negative on the principle that we tend to develop superficial relationships to what we have an abundance of, and also the economic models that seem not to benefit the artists that produce the music.
Okay. Ahmed, cosmetic surgery.
In terms of looking at what's discussing today about AI, I would say net negative because it promotes fake images of people most of the time.
Okay. Michael, last one, the assembly line, Fordism.
net negative, I suppose, in the quality of the human experience. You know, if we're looking merely at the availability of stuff, then perhaps net positive. But the principles apply that have colonized other areas of human life are net negative if we apply the principles of efficiency.
Ahmed, I have to ask you this question. When you built your model on, you know, creative artists or geniuses, what came up for the most underrated artists? What were the two or three most underrated artists based on your AI model?
That's a good question. It depends on your experience in art. For example, when I did these models, I didn't know much about Kazimir Malevich, the Russian artist, and AI rated him one of the highest scoring creative artists of history. And that brought my attention to who is this Kazimir Malevich and what did he do. And AI rated his art like the black square and red square as very high score. Again, this is something that I didn't know much history about, but when I read about it and when I look at it, I find very, very interesting that art historian would agree about things like red square and black square and things as very creative pieces of art. Normal people would not. But really, that would make somebody like Kazimir Malevich, Mondrian, very underrated artist.
Okay, thank you. Michael, last question for you, and then we'll sort of close it up. When you heard Ahmed talk about him being a geek and also potentially his view that extroverts are overrated, there is a lot about human connection, which is about reaching out, connecting. Do you think the geeks are undermining human connection? Do you think introverts are undermining human connection just by being quiet and staying in their homes?
As an introvert, self-acknowledged introvert, I don't know. I think it's the context in which we might seek the connection, right? So I think what we have maybe is a social structures that lean towards being conducive to extroverted human relationships and contexts in which introverts may struggle to find the appropriate context within which their mode of human connectivity might flourish. You know, whether geeks are undermining, I think that's too broad a way of phrasing that question. I think many of the tools which maybe we might think of arising out of geek culture have had, unhelpful effects for the way we relate to one another or fail to relate to one another. I think many of the ways in which, again, the grain of contemporary digital technology is basically to render us passive consumers who are isolated in our homes and receive our goods and services through a portal, and we never make that contact with the person. And we've come to perceive human connection as an inefficiency that we're less likely to tolerate. Those are a couple of comments along those lines. Yeah.
And I think on that note, we are definitely going to close.
Thank you so much.
Michael and Ahmed, thank you so much. We look forward to speaking to you soon. Thank you.
If you enjoyed the show, we'd love you to leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. It really goes a long way to helping others discover our conversations. You can also find Principle of Charity on social media, where we hope you'll join the discussion. See you soon.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.